This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show dedicated to the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today...
And they identified to them, a serious issue of puffins needing sunglasses.
Ollie Stratford, editor-in-chief of the lustrous design quarterly Disegno, is in studio unpacking a few design-minded finds for the summer. Plus...
So for me, those books remind me to experiment, because to experiment and to try things and even to make mistakes, I think that is crucial if you want to develop.
We'll be dipping back into a discussion with Irma Boom, the Dutch design maestro whose majestic work on the printed page has earned her the title the Queen of Books. Long may she reign. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24. Do stay tuned. And a very warm welcome to On Design. We're beginning today's programme with a survey of some of the bigger design stories and perhaps some that you've missed this week and month. I'm delighted to say that I'm joined in studio by friend of the show, scholar and editor-in-chief of that fabulous design quarterly, Disegno, Ollie Stratford. Welcome back.
Well, thanks very much for the warm welcome.
And you've prepared a rather beautiful series of stories to run us through, some that people may be aware of. We're talking about Apple, some of the biggest companies in the world, and some that people may have missed. And I want to start off, because there's nothing I love more than an acronym that takes longer to say than the actual name of a company. And we're going to talk about the merger of Isocon and Very Good and Proper, which apparently is said VG&P.
VG&P,
for short.
Yeah.
For short.
Well, it's kind of fun to say VG&P. It sort of pops. Yeah, no, it's quite a sweet story, really. Summer tends to be a little bit of a downtime for the design industry. Not masses happen. So
not for you, Ollie.
you know, no rest for the wicked. But this was a story which has just been announced and is quite intriguing. So Isocon Plus, it's a plywood furniture manufacturer and one which has this very storied history. So Isocon grows out of Jack Pritchard's Isocon Furniture Company, which is founded in the first half of the 20th century. And they work with a lot of the sort of Bauhaus exiles when they come across to leafy North London from Germany. And they produce some really nice works. I think Breuer does some pieces for them, for instance. And then over the course of the 20th century, Isocon's sort of fortunes go up and down a little bit until it's reformed as Isocon Plus. And they worked with some really significant contemporary designers. So Barbara and Osgoby, I suppose, are the big ones. And they have a nice product range, but haven't always maybe gotten the attention some of that heritage and history deserves. So the partnership with Very Good and Proper, which is a much more recent company, founded in 2008, I think, during the height of the financial crash. They've done very well, all things considered.
Well, the thing I wanted to ask you is, obviously mergers are fraught with opportunities and they're fraught with potential dangers. They're going to move the production to the VG&P premises. But I suppose this will give Isocon the capacity to make more and, I suppose, different equipment and access to new resources, which perhaps the company has lacked. VG&P have done or kitted out offices, should I say, for Facebook, for Google, for BBC. There's a difference in scale, which I suppose could be a good thing.
I think they both benefit from it. So Isocon absolutely get VG&P's network. I think it will bring them to a much broader attention, particularly internationally. In exchange, Isocon are really, really strong on making. They have really great prototyping and sort of expertise within that company. So I think VG&P have worked with them on that basis for a number of years, and I suppose this is formalising it a little bit. So they're keen to position it as a sort of win-win.
So I guess the take-home from this is it's nothing to do with Brexit, apparently, which is one thing that both companies have said. And I suppose that we need to keep out an eye on Isocon Plus, potentially moving more into the commercial world, and VG&P perhaps, you know, sharpening up some of their products for maybe the domestic market. Who knows? Next up, I'd like to talk about Apple, an insurmountably big company about which I know almost nothing, although I have many of their products surrounding me as we speak. Apple are investing in augmented reality. Why on earth are they doing such a thing, Ollie?
Well, I suppose it's the brave new digital future and all the excitement of virtual worlds. But yeah, it's quite a nice initiative. So Apple have launched a trio of augmented reality programs in their stores. Some are based in stores, others are artist walks around a city using an app. So you experience an augmented version of Hong Kong, Paris, London or whatever. And they've partnered with the Whitney Museum. Sorry, incorrect. The New Museum in New York to commission artists for that. So that's quite a nice new program, and I think ties into some broader shifts at Apple. So Apple, of course, recently losing Jony Ive, their long-term design head, the sort of industrial designer who put Apple on the map and made it that kind of archetype of a design-led company. He's off to form his own consultancy, Lovefrom, that's still going to work with Apple. There's been a lot of discussion about why he's leaving. I think first thing worth saying is no one knows for sure. It's all speculation. But one of the more compelling arguments I've heard is that Apple is no longer this kind of straight-up purist technology company, innovating new categories and putting out sort of the iPod, the iPhone, Apple Watch and so on. They've become much more interested in being a service company as well. So they're launching a streaming service later in the year. They've just launched a credit card, slightly bafflingly. And I think this sort of augmented reality, that ties in as well. I think like a lot of industries, they're getting more interested in experience and the provision of content. And so maybe moving away from that previous very product-driven model they had.
Yeah, great insight. I appreciate that. And I suppose as sales slow and growth remains pretty sluggish, and you have these big companies like Alphabet investing in literally every aspect of our lives in the hope or speculation that it may become important, Apple is kind of, I suppose, playing the stock market a little bit on its bets. But I wonder what augmented reality, what future it sees in it. I'd love to sit in one of those board meetings and see the 25-year plan for it, because I don't think it is art walks.
No, probably not. I suppose this is more a way to get people involved with the technology and to open it up beyond just being a sort of tool or technology and make it into more of an experience. I agree, I don't think it's going to be the future or anything like that, but I think it's sort of sugaring the pill a little bit and getting people used to it and seeing what they can make of it in this kind of friendly, open format.
And Ollie, you'd also like to talk about new hires for heads of diversity at Chanel and Gucci.
Yeah, so Fiona Padgett has joined Chanel, head of diversity and inclusion. Gucci has just made a similar appointment after its scandals earlier this year, so I think this is something you're going to see more of. In principle, I think it could be a very good idea. Like, leaving aside the specific people in those positions, I don't know them, I don't know their work, so it wouldn't be fair for me to judge.
You're so even-handed on, you should host this show.
In principle, it's not a bad thing for a company to signal that it takes these issues seriously by putting someone in that role. The issue is, it's very hard to know what that role exactly is. Like, you can't just look online and see the job description as to what they're doing. So I've found at least the reporting on it so far to be this very muddled and muddy situation of, well, Is this person responsible for policing the output of the design studio and what's coming in the collections? Are they just a sort of last check to make sure there's, like, well, nothing racist in there, nothing bigoted in any way? Or are they responsible also for hiring? Do they have a say in diversity in the design team? Because that's the issue that comes up again and again. And I think it's not that clear. I think there's also a little bit maybe of an arms race of clearly companies have identified there's an issue here, and rightly so, and it's good they're doing something about it. But perhaps a little bit of competition to be seen as the company doing the most about it and using it in itself maybe as a marketing tool. I don't know in these specific examples if that's the case, but in general, I wouldn't be surprised.
And finally, a topic about which I'm allowed to be a little flippant, I hope. Puffins, do they need sunglasses?
It's my favourite project in a long time. So it's the Interaction Research Studio at Goldsmiths University. And I think they're a little bit of an underappreciated gem in some ways. They've been going for a number of years and they do any number of fabulous projects. There's one called My Nature Watch, for instance, where they've been making these kind of hacked cameras you can make out of odds and ends you've got laying around the house to create little camera traps for birds and things like that. And it's just a sort of group of designers who play around a little bit. They prototype very rapidly. They find situations they can get involved in. And they identified, or it wasn't identified to them, a serious issue of puffins needing sunglasses.
That sounds like a serious issue.
It's a very serious issue. It's very important. They've got to look cool. It was actually for some scientific research. So they were looking into bioluminescence in puffin beaks. God knows why. But I'm glad someone's doing it. And as part of the testing, you have to shine UV light, which is very damaging to the eyes if it shines directly on them. So it is flippant and it is ridiculous, but it's also lovely and has a serious side. So they made these little, really well put together sunglasses that pop onto the beak and the puffin's happy. But then a really funny thing is they're not allowed any photography of the puffins because the scientists are worried it's sort of... diminishes the work a little bit, and potentially if you put out images of your team making puffins wear sunglasses on Twitter or the web, that could deteriorate quite quickly as a situation.
I think the great irony of that is that someone has not taken the best marketing opportunity I've ever heard to get their work known. So it, you're right.
They're very laudable. And I would recommend people look them up. The Interaction Research Studio at Goldsmiths, they really do some fabulous work.
And sadly, that's all we have time for with you, Ollie. Thank you so much for coming in. You're listening to Monocle on Design. In a moment, we'll be speaking to the fated Dutch book designer, Irma Boom. Don't go away. Now, Dutch designer Irma Boom has been rethinking book design since the 1980s, and her work, which sees her approach the structure and flow of a book with the scrupulous eye of an architect, goes well beyond the front cover. Do judge a book by its cover, she seems to say. She's collaborated with artists such as Olafur Eliasson, plus design and fashion brands numbering Vitra and Chanel. Oh, and she's won awards, of course, including the Leipzig Gutenberg Prize for her uncompromising, experimental and artful creations. In February 2019, if you remember that, Monocle's business editor, Venetia Rainey, who herself claims to be half Dutch, spoke to the designer during a visit to her studio in Amsterdam.
I'm Irma Boom. I'm a bookmaker in Amsterdam. I have a small office with two assistants and one intern. And yeah, I work 24/7, I guess.
24/7. What are you working on at the moment? What's the project taking up your time?
So I'm working on many projects. I always think that I'm lazy, so that I need a lot to do. I always keep plates in the air, and that gives me a lot of adrenaline.
You mentioned that you're working on something for the Rijksmuseum. Can we talk about that briefly?
Yeah, so I work already, I think, 15 years for the Rijksmuseum, even when they were so-called closed. The small part was open, and I started working for them. And they reopened, I think, 5 years ago. And then they asked me to make the logo, and I always thought, if the big museum opens, they invite a big design office or agency to work on their new identity, but they asked me. So the tiny, tiny office. And so I made a logo for them with a space, Rijks Space Museum, which people were not happy with it, because in Holland, Rijksmuseum is one word. But in the Netherlands, we have the so-called Space Police, and the Space Police said it was wrong that the National Museum for sure had to spell Rijksmuseum right. And that's as one word, but I thought Rijks is such a weird word, so I wanted to make it more as an image. I also, we have the letters IJ, which is a sound, A, which only Dutch people can pronounce, and then the word museum is generic. So I thought it's specific and generic, and then with the space it's very special. But anyway, it caused a lot of rumor, but in the end people said, well, I didn't change the word Rijksmuseum. I made a logo, so it's artistic freedom, and so all professors from universities were all protecting me and giving arguments why it was good what I did. But anyway, so I work for the Rijksmuseum, and before I did small works for the Rijksmuseum, but now I do all their books, which is amazing. And I also do design exhibitions, and that's for me fantastic. So at the moment, there are two new exhibitions, and both we designed, and especially the older Rembrandt exhibition, which is amazing that the museum shows all the Rembrandts they have, which is about 400 works. The paintings are on grey walls, so it's a combination of blue and grey, but the blue walls are in a sort of harmonica.
So clearly you do stuff other than books, which not a lot of people know. Do you get sick of being known as the queen of books and being pigeonholed like that?
Oh, but I am the book person. I think even if I make an exhibition as a book designer, I'm also an editor. And in my little red book, I also say that you can compare the work I'm doing like a film director. It's all about giving direction, like Elements of Architecture, which I did with Rem Koolhaas. I was also the director. I made a sort of system how to read that book with 2,500 pages. So it's giving directions, it's editing and helping people how to manage so much information. It's really, directing. But to make an exhibition is exactly the same. It's also making a direction and helping people how to get the best out of it if they spend an hour or 2 hours in a museum. You need to help them how to look and where to look and what is interesting. And that's directing, but in a very seamless way. If people go to the museum to see the Rembrandt exhibition, they hardly feel my design, but it's definitely there. And that's the same with, for example, the Elements of Architecture book. It's a sort of concept. It's an idea, which I do without a compromise. And for me, making an exhibition is making a book, and making a book is making an exhibition. For me, the difference is not that big, but I am a bookmaker. Making books is what I do 98% of my job.
I'm really intrigued by something that I read that you said in another interview. You said that your work is never, never art, but you do consider it architecture. Where's that line for you and why? Why is it never art? Why does that bother you?
Well, I went to art school to become a painter. And I thought that for me, but that's really the reason. If you're a painter in the best way, like there was an artist in the Netherlands called Daan van Golden, which I admire hugely. He was this autonomous person who he didn't even know the word. He died, unfortunately, a few years ago. But he did whatever he wanted to do, and he always had the necessity from inside to make a silkscreen, to make a painting, to make a photograph. Also, for him, the medium didn't matter. It was the eye which made it a Daan van Golden piece. And Daan didn't produce that much work. He only did what he thought he should do. So for me, I had this enormous admiration, but I didn't know what to do. When I was at art school, I always and studying painting, I didn't know what to do. I really thought I need somebody to ask me something, then I get to work. So for me, there is a sort of difference that if you want to make something that it's like an artist, it comes from yourself. It's not commissioned. Of course, in the Rijksmuseum, Rembrandt, Vermeer, they're all commissioned, but they also were autonomous thinkers and makers. And I had a feeling that I needed to be commissioned. And there, for me, is the line.
Do you have a book that you're most proud of? Or perhaps a book that you feel didn't quite get to the place you wanted it to get to?
Well, it's interesting. So if I give a lecture somewhere, I always bring the real books. I never show a PDF, and my books are not PDFs, because I work with the book and how a book functions. So it's turning the pages. There is a sequence, there's a weight, there's a smell, there's a size, there's a proportion. So for me, that's really important. So if I give a talk, I bring a suitcase with books. Always one suitcase because books are so heavy.
How many books can you fit in that suitcase?
It depends what I bring. Before, I always took two suitcases with 21 books. I am totally into numerology. It always has to do something with three. So to Kosovo last week, I brought 12 books because one and two is three. So the books I always bring is the SHV Think book I started to make in 1990, which was a pivotal moment in bookmaking because then internet was new and became more democratic, because it was, of course, already there, but then people started to use it. And that was a jubilee book for a multinational based here in the Netherlands. And then I thought, well, if you get a project on which you can work 5 years, let's do something special. But then in the end, it was so new, the new media. By the end, after 5 years, imagine if we would have made a CD-ROM. DVD didn't exist. Then you couldn't play it anymore. So that's why I decided to make a book, but a book based on the idea of internet. So that's a book I always bring because I tell that story. Why? And it's a book with 2,136 pages. It's really important because the book is a voyage. Like searching on the internet, it's browsing through a book. You find things you were not looking for and the other way around. So that book for me is really in my, if you can say, career, a pivotal moment. Then I bring one set of old books. It's the so-called postage stamp books I made in 1988. They are books which, even if I show it now, it looks if I made it yesterday. They don't look dated at all. They're 31 years old. I cannot believe it. Then I feel really old. But those books I show because when I made those books, I was working for the state, for the government printing and publishing house. But I was fearless. I was young. And I was a totally fearless designer. And I wish always that I was as fearless as then. So for me, those books remind me to experiment, because to experiment and to try things and even to make mistakes, I think that is crucial if you want to develop and if you want to develop in, for me, in bookmaking. Then I bring the Chanel book, where I didn't use any ink. It's about Chanel 5. And it was a book for an exhibition in the Palais de Tokyo a few years ago. And that book, I show that that's for me the ultimate book, where the book doesn't exist as a PDF at all. It only exists as the piece you have in your hand. So a book cannot be more a book as a Chanel book.
Because it's embossed, right?
Yeah.
So you can almost barely read it. You need a certain light, I imagine.
Yeah, so you can definitely read it, but not in when there's no light, but then you cannot read any book. We're sitting in my studio here in Amsterdam with some sunlight. So it's a white book with only embossing text and image is embossed. And I came up with that idea because I think, as you smell, I have Chanel. I wear since I'm 14 Chanel. So it's very present, but you don't see it. And I wanted to make a book which you basically don't see yet is very present. And so then I thought, how can I achieve it? And then I thought, well, by embossing and debossing. And so it's a book which has the proportion of the Chanel bottle, Chanel 5, and it's 5 centimeters thick. So I do a lot of counting. When I'm designing, I'm always, it's not, oh, I do this or that. Everything has a reason. And that's for me, because I consider myself as a bad designer, so I always have to find reasons why I'm doing things.
I'm curious as to what kind of books you read. Do you judge books by their cover when you're selecting them for your own pleasure?
Well, I think it is interesting when books are well designed and thought of. It's not about good or bad, actually, but when there's a good thought. I became a book designer because of cover design and because of the content. In the 60s and 70s, we had a wonderful, famous author called Jan Wolkers, and he worked with one of the greatest typographers in the Netherlands called Jan Vermeulen. If you see the cover and if you read the books, it's an extremely good fit. And that's actually why I became a book designer. I read the books, and then the teacher told me why the cover was so good. And because of that notion, because at first I didn't look at it, I didn't even think about it, I realized that there is a profession called book design or graphic design. I didn't know, but somebody had to tell me. And if you see those books, yeah, content and form are one, and they're extremely well made. I have a library here above my studio, and in the library I have books from the 60s and from 1400 and 1500. And the books which are in my library, I'm rereading because I really want to know, oh yeah, I've read them years ago, but what were they about? So I'm rereading my own library. I spent last year 5 months studying at the Vatican Library. And there I also realized if you make books, you make books for the future. Because what I studied there were books from 500 after Christ, 750 after Christ, and then up to the 1400s, 1500s, because after that the book becomes very standardized as we know it. So I see books as a part of culture, and for me a book is a container of thought, and because it's not changeable, it's fixed information and you have to turn the pages, I think that notion makes the book extremely valuable. So even maybe again Elements of Architecture, because it's a recent book with Rem Koolhaasen and Harvard GSD, there we worked for 6 years on collecting or making also more an encyclopedia on the floor, on the wall, on the window, on the ceiling, 15 elements, to collect knowledge or thought in an edited form, which for me is the book, and print it in the book. The book becomes a reference. The book is really the container of thought. And if you compare it to internet, where you can change anytime, any second, you never can create that one thought, that reference. And I think in that sense, the book is crucial to freeze a moment in time. That book is that one idea. And if you print something, you have to think about it. You cannot just print something. You have to think about it because it's there and it will not disappear. And it will be there for a long time. So it is important what you do. With internet, of course, you have the same, because if you put a thought on the internet, in 1 second, it's all over the world, but you can also take it away. And that's, I think, the interesting thing about making books, that it's this frozen moment, the world is set still for a moment. And I think that's crucial. That's why I want to make books.
Would you ever consider working on digital books? Something that is frozen, but is very flat? Does that appeal to you at all?
But I think the whole idea of a book, the Codex, exists since 400 after Christ, before we had the papyrus and etc. And for me, a book is really the paper. If I think of a book, it's a paper book. And I think the e-reader or Kindle is something else. Of course, it's text and its information. And I'm really interested to work on it. Nobody ever asked me, and I wonder why. I think it would be super interesting to do.
Here's your chance. E-reader commissioners is waiting.
Yes, come. But it's the same with the whole idea of websites. I do work on the ideas of website because I think, it's crucial. And I also think that we are talking here today because I'm the book designer in the time of the digital age, and I could articulate much more than maybe if there was no internet. So I'm very aware of what a book is. So I articulate it. I made a book for Victor and Rolf, which is also here. It's a book I don't carry because it's too big. So I don't show it on lectures. So I always ask if I do a lecture somewhere, what books they have so that they bring them, so I don't have to carry them. But anyway, that's a book with only covers. So I really try to find the significance of what still a book is. And so for me to develop the whole idea of a book is important, because like the Victor and Rolf book could never be a PDF. It's the object. It's the thing by turning the pages in different ways. You can turn pages to the right, you can turn pages to the left. It's a book with only, it's called Cover, which only exists of covers. I made covers because they're fashion designers. They work with layering. I made a book with 60 layers. So it's like their work. It's a sculpture. And so there are many reasons to still make a book.
Designer Irma Boom there speaking to Monocle's Venetia Rainey back in February 2019. Sadly, that's all we have time for on today's show. Don't forget, if you'd like to hear more design stories, you can subscribe to this show or our sister show, Monocle on Design Extra. How do we come up with these names? It's available each Thursday. You could also head to your local newsstand and seek out a copy of the Monocle Summer Weekly Newspaper, an issue of the monthly magazine, or, if it's your thing, the Monocle Drinking and Dining Directory, which is also out now. Monocle on Design was produced by Tom Hall. It was edited by May Lee Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.